Yes, can you clarify something for me? If you've got an outside company coming in,
yeah,
whatever money is generated, that leaves the country.
Yes.
Whatever employment they have.
What matters is local added value. What value is added here in Ireland through direct workforce, through the workforce of Irish suppliers, through paid Irish costs, etc. That's what matters. But you're so right. The profits, if all the, say it's a manufacturing business, and the inputs all come in from outside, and then the profits all go out again, then that's all lost. But what happened in Ireland in the 80s was, and government came to terms with this, was our wage rates increased dramatically from the mid-70s. Our costs increased dramatically. We became a very uncompetitive place. If you're competing in international markets, Ireland was not the place to be. If, this is important, if you were making something, generally manufacturing involved large workforces with relatively simple skills. Mm. Ireland decided to opt for a model of much more sophisticated skills, work that required higher level skills, such as information technology, areas of the pharmaceutical industry and so on, where, being honest about it, differences in wage rates were not that important.
Yeah.
Because wages, as you can see, were a small part. In biscuit making, wages could be 30-35% of the total cost. In pharmaceuticals, it might be 3%. So a 20% difference in the pharmaceutical industry meant nothing in the biscuit industry, wiped you out. And we went that road. Meanwhile, in the older firms, like Jacobs, this meant huge change.
Yeah.
Huge reshaping of the... If you wanted to stay in business, you had to reshape. Inevitably, it meant you had to scale down. And you had to concentrate on your strengths. In the case of Jacobs, I would have said, I did say, that means that we reserve all our marketing expenditure, our investment, all our research effort behind products that are unique to us.
Mm-hmm.
We were lucky we had unique products, like fig rolls, like mallow biscuits, like cream crackers, things that we did better than anybody else. We had know-how. We had difference. I always used to say, I'm never going to say Irish biscuits are better than English biscuits, but I will say they're different.
Right. But you were unique in that sense.
Yes,
you had this.
Unique.
What happened then? I mean, why did things start to go wrong?
Well, go wrong, I suppose. It was going to be a smaller business. Had to be a smaller business.
Downsize.
Yes. And it was encased in this big, as I said at the start, I said an hour or so ago, this big factory was far too big anyway.
Yeah.
But it was certainly far too big when it was emerging. Meanwhile, looking out at the world outside, one could see big blocks, corporate blocks were forming everywhere. Everybody was joining a bigger group. Our opportunity came, the English Jacobs company that was in Liverpool had, in the 60s, following this trend, joined with two other British biscuit makers, Huntley and Palmer's, world famous in Reading, and Peak Freen, and formed a company called Associated Biscuits. And they thrived, they did very well, and they made a number of efforts. In fact, they owned 29% of Jacobs. They got that by buying all the shares in the Dublin company from the family members in Britain.
I see.
But they got to 25-26%, and they built up to 29%. They couldn't go any further. And so that way they had a foot in the camp. And the sister put somebody on the board. And they wanted, in fact, to buy the Dublin business. I wasn't very keen on that, because I felt that...
Would that not have been a good decision?
No, I think logically they'd have closed the factory in Dublin.
And you saw that?
Oh, yeah. It was obvious, because they had major surplus capacity in Britain.
Yeah.
Wage rates in Britain were so much less. So it was, you know, And we talked to the government here about it. The government were not at all happy that this should happen, but there's a limit what the government can do. But we kept talking to each other. Anyway, meanwhile, overtaken by events, they were taken out by a French company called BSN.
Mm.
No, correction. They were bought out by Nabisco, the big American multinational.
Yeah.
And that's a strange story in that normally, I suppose, Nabisco would have taken us out as well, but the very top people in Nabisco in America, it was a vast company in America, were Irish or of Irish descent. And we were hugely lucky. We had a wonderful relationship with them, and we coexisted very easily. You know, they put somebody on our board, and they were very happy the way the Dublin business was run, and they were very happy about the results we got. And they said, "Look, you people are doing fine. Keep going." And I think they appreciated the kind of the English Irish British Irish thing, and they didn't want to disturb anything, and they were wonderful shareholders. They sold their worldwide biscuits outside America to BSN, the French company, now Danone, the yogurt maker. And the French bought the British business in 1989. And they had huge difficulty. French and English companies have huge difficulty relating to each other. And they were concerned at the fact there were two Jacobs operating in the biscuit business. It bothered them. And we talked about it, and I felt we had a good relationship with the French, which we did. And we agreed in 2-3 years later, 1991 I think it was, yes, that Danone would buy Jacobs in Dublin. They bought out the shareholders and they paid them a fine price. The people who invested money in Jacobs over the years did very, very well, including the family people. And as a result of that, we joined what was at the time a huge family of biscuit companies through Europe, Lou in France and Saiwa in Italy and so on. And we had a seat at the table, so to say. So it was a good thing for the Irish.
Did it seem a good thing?
It was a good thing.
Because that was to change, wasn't it?
That was, yes. It was a good thing at the time. The idea was that the Dublin factory would concentrate more on products. Now, I think here my own kind of vantage point changes, because after the French took over, I wanted to leave. I wanted to.
But you had lost your control then, really, or not lost your control, but
oh yeah,
but you had lost your superiority.
The company was no longer a self. It wasn't an Irish independent public company, and from my point of view, I'd spent the previous whatever number of years it was almost running my own show. And I felt 20-some years later, it was time to move on and do something else. I told the French that, and they were very good about it. They said, no, you can't do that. We want people, we want you to stay, and also they found Britain difficult to deal with, and they asked me to become chairman of the Dublin company, which I did, and I gave up the chief executive role, and also become chairman of the British company, which I did. And I worked that role for about 2 or 3 years. So I kind of had an overview. But the intention originally was that production, not just to Britain and Ireland, but across Europe, would be rationalised. Mm-hmm. You know, particular factories would specialise in particular products. And then they would have access to the European distribution network. The theory was good. I think a lot of people in Dublin possibly, you see, we'd always been on our own. And I'm not sure we were well equipped. A lot of our people were well equipped to join into a bigger group, so to say. Having said that, the French always said that they thought the Irish people, the Irish employees were exceptional people. One man, I remember one consultant who once, he was somebody with tremendous experience of their factories, he came into my office in Dublin one day and said, you know, he says, your people are extraordinarily good. And I remember saying to him, look, you've been here for 3 or 4 hours. What qualifies you to say that? And he gave me as good as he got. He said, well, he said, I'll tell you something, he said, I walked around your factory just now. And every worker I met looked at me face to face, eyeball to eyeball. And generally they had a smile. He said, you go to the place with people with their head down, they ignore you, they're afraid to look at you, or they're not interested. He said, your people are totally different. It was an interesting observation. But I left the UK role around 1996, I think. I remained involved with the Dublin Company on a very, very non-executive basis in the late 90s. I felt the integration process never really, it never happened as I certainly would have wished. Why, I'm not entirely certain, but of course, events were to overtake everything and everybody. It was Danone wound down their biscuit business. They were huge in dairy products. That's their worldwide, the biggest company in the world in dairy products. They were huge in beer, very big brewers across Europe, huge in dairy waters, or mineral waters rather. The biscuits was one of 5 or 6 divisions. But I think they never really got their arms around the biscuit business. The other businesses were like Danone, yogurts was what I call a unitary product. I mean, it was like Coca-Cola. It went right across the world. Things like Volvic or mineral water, again, huge product. But the biscuits were fragmented. You had Jacob's Mallows, you had Cyber Crackers, you had Lou chocolate biscuits. It probably didn't suit their approach.
Their style of business.
Their style of business. But this is all retrospect and hindsight. So they packed that up. And then Jacobs, as we know, I say as we know because I know very little, it all broke up, basically. And it's quite sad. But I would say to you, from my own standpoint, this is when I left the last day of the last century. That was my last direct involvement. And I'm a great believer in life. When you move on, you move on.
Yeah.
You know, now what happened? I mean, you have Michael Carey took over here, etc. But in a way, you know, Jacobs in Dublin was a major force for the guts of 150 years.
Yeah.
It employed, I once worked out that up to 100,000 people worked in Bishop Street.
Imagine that.
Over a long period. It gave wonderfully good employment relative to the times that were in it.
Yes.
To countless Dublin families.
Yeah.
It certainly gave, in my case, 25 years of wonderful, wonderful experience for me and my family, I must say, and I hope others would say about themselves and their families. It's a wonderful institution, it's a wonderful company. But, you know, I'm reminded, when I look at some of the modern industries, everything has its day.
Can I ask you, in the 27 years that you were there, what did you learn yourself from it? What can you take from it, and what have you learned?
Oh, people, everything. People. Oh, yeah. You, people, and okay, my role was a leadership role, obviously. And the one thing I did learn was, if you are totally open and honest with the people you lead, if you're fair to them, if you commit to them, you can get... I'm talking here, I suppose, essentially about Dublin people, because that's what most of them were. Most of them were Dubs, and they were fantastic people.
Yeah.
They really were. Even I talked about periods of strikes, for instance. And I'll just tell you one little incident that maybe illustrates a lot. We were in the middle of a very difficult strike. sometime in the 1980s, overpay, which wasn't of the workers' making or my making, in the sense of, you know, the unions were leading this charge for 15%, whatever it was. And Jacobs was a high-profile company, a highly unionised employer. We were kind of up front, if you like. And it was neither my choice nor the workers' choice, but that's where we were. And particular weekend in the middle of this whole thing, the lads and girls at the factory used to be very big in a thing called the Tops of the Town, John Player thing. And they were on in Athlone, the final, semi-finals or something. And normally Anne, my wife and myself, we always would have gone, wherever they were on, we would have gone to it. And I came home one day and said to her, my God, you know, I said, the Tops of the Town people are in Athlone on Saturday. She says, what am I going to do? What am I going to do at all? You know, I'd like to go, and yet I'm afraid if I go, I could cause a riot. And she said to me, look, she said, I said, I know, she said, you have a good relationship with the people there. She said, I reckon they'd want you to go.
Yeah.
Well, I rarely consulted my wife about business things, but this was a kind of a personal thing. So I said, look, should we go? I remember walking into the place they were before the show in Athlone, I get a huge round of applause.
And that meant a lot to you.
It meant a huge amount to me. And I walked around, I talked to every single one of them, and we all talked, look, whatever the hell happens, we're going to stick together. And it was a wonderful thing. I must say, you know, that that's the kind of people they were.
Yeah.
And I hope, as I say, in talking to the various people you talked to, I hope you get... naturally, we're a huge group of people. Everybody wasn't happy. It couldn't be. You know, there'd be some people more than others. The end, the way the business ended, as it was sad, I could well understand for many people who spent their entire lives in the company. It must be very different. The social club is still there, I think.
Yeah.
The
they do. They meet.
They meet there, don't they? Yeah.
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 It's extraordinary. You know, we've been speaking a long time about. Do you know Leo O'Donnell? The story of Jacobs told from a man who's, I suppose, leading the pack for many years. I appreciate you telling me the story, and thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you.